Coaches win games. Administrations win championships. Like, we all know.
On today's episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast, we are joined by Coach Patrick Crary, the head men's basketball coach at Grambling State University. Coach Crary was hired in 2024 after a successful 11-year tenure as head coach and athletic director at St. Thomas University in Florida. While at St. Thomas, he led the program to multiple national tournament appearances and was known for his ability to build and sustain success at the NAIA level. Before that, he served as an assistant at his alma mater, Marymount University, and spent time coaching at the high school and grassroots levels. Crary is respected for his leadership, culture building, and adaptability across all levels of basketball. At Grambling, he's focused on taking the program to new heights within the SWAC. In this episode, we talk about what he looks for when hiring an assistant from an athletic director as well as head coach's standpoint, things to consider when looking to take that next coaching position in a school, and how to alter your offense and defense around a roster when stepping into a new program. Please welcome to the podcast, Coach Patrick Crary. Dr. Dish Basketball, the number one selling shooting machine in the world, provides the most innovative game-like training with on-demand workouts, multiplayer stat tracking, and instant analytics that allow coaches and players to be better every day. All you have to do is mention Rising Coaches for an exclusive discount on a Dr. Dish shooting machine for your team. Coaches, appreciate you all being with us today. On deck, we have a great conversation coming up with a current head coach, longtime head coach. But before we get to that, I have to give a shout out to something that we've been working on. I know we've been mentioning this. This is the last couple days to be able to sign up for the Rising Coaches Conference, collabing with US Nation Camps and Snow Valley Camps, Westmont College, Santa Barbara, California, July 22nd. Make sure you sign up for it. As I said, we are right around the corner for it. That being said, we are here and graced to be able to learn from the current head coach, Grambling State University, Coach Patrick Crary. Coach Crary, welcome.
Thanks, fellas. Thanks for having me. Excited to be back. And I was on this, I want to say 2019.
And okay.
I was doing a piece as an AD years ago when I was doing AD and coaching work. So excited to be back for sure.
Yeah, this time with just one hat, which is even better.
I do want to make sure to bring that up at some point because I know that I saw that, and that's obviously great, especially coming from the athletic director standpoint. You had to do hiring, maybe not for the head coaching position because you were the head coach, but you did have to do hiring for other coaching positions. Plus, being a head coach, obviously you have to do hiring as well. But we'll touch on that at one point. But ultimately, for you, right, you have been a head coach. You had a short stop of an assistant roles. You've been a head coach for a great period of time now. What lit the fire for you in the profession, and like what kind of pushed you into the coaching role?
It's crazy. So my dad is a doctor. My mom's a clinical therapist. My grandfather's a doctor, and I'm Jamaican. So you got to understand, like in my household, like I'm a failure because you got to be a doctor, a lawyer, a CEO. That's like the running joke that we have. Like, it's better now. The early years were rough. But for me, I've seen people talk about following your passion and making it your career. I saw something recently where this lady was talking about follow your talents and make it your passion. And I was coaching a 9-and-under team. I was actually playing at La Sierra University. One of the teammates was on the girls' team, and she said, hey, we got an AAU program, mom and pop. Everybody's got to pay money. We need some coaches. So me, Brian Wright, who's currently the general manager for the San Antonio Spurs. So myself, Brian Wright, Tim McCoy, who's a NICU nurse now at 6'5", 300 pounds, and one of my other friends, we went over there and we started coaching, and I'm coaching these kids and they're listening. And fast forward 4 years, they moved me from 9-and-under to 13-and-under to 16-and-under to 17-and-under, and I was really good. And so it was something like anybody knows when you do something and you have talent, sometimes you pick up stuff a little faster than other people or you understand things differently. I was just blessed to have that talent that God helped me with. I really got into the profession because I knew I could win. And I knew it was something I really wanted to do. And so that year I was an assistant, it was 2 years. We were 0-11. My coach was also the AD. He went to the NCAA convention for AD work for 2 days, for two games, excuse me. He told me, he said, hey, Pat, you're going to be the head coach now. We won both games. We had a team we lost to by 30, Laverne University, D3 in California. We lost by 30. I knew I was going to coach them, so I went back for Christmas break, and we had back, this is back VHS days. So I'm at my mom and dad's house for Christmas break. I want to say I'm 23, maybe 22. Pop in that VHS. I didn't do nothing but Christmas break, watch the VHS. I said, bro, they're running two plays. We can't stop these two plays. What are we doing? So I get back, coach the guys. We win the game, close game. We win the game, and then we won another game. We had lost 11 in a row. My coach leaves. I come back. I win two games. And what I really think helped my career is when my coach came back, I just fell back in line as the assistant and did exactly what he asked me to do. And he's the guy who got me the job at Washington at Venice. And if I had, a lot of times as assistant, you know how it is. I want my own program. I can do this. I can do that. And sometimes you might have a little bit of friction there. And as a young coach, that would have been an easy place for me to act like I knew what I was doing when I absolutely didn't know what I was doing. I just won two games. I didn't know nothing. But keeping that relationship with Joe Haldeman, he actually had coached with the current AD at Washington at Venice back then. And so when they were making a change and they were looking for a young person to come in and be the assistant AD, he recommended me, he called me, and it was done. And if I had turned my back on him during that time period, we would not be having this conversation.
Yeah, no, that's so good you say that, man. Especially for young assistant coaches, which a lot of, you know, Rising Coaches, followers, members are in that boat. They want to, they're ambitious, and that's great. But you also want to keep that in perspective too, because if you had let your ambition get out of control and all of a sudden those 11 games and you win two, and all of a sudden you're still trying to hang on to that head coaching thing after your head coach came back, then that's a problem. So just being able to say to your boss, how can I help? And that's literally what you did. When he came back, it's okay. What happened? It is what it is. But my role is an assistant coach. And so to play that out to the fullest the way you did, you probably look back now and realizing you appreciated doing that. And as opposed to, there's a wrong turn that you can make there, and that wrong turn is not going to end well.
No, like it's just God protected me and then telling me what to do, pushing me in that way. I'm really faith-based, Seventh-day Adventist. And so, I mean, he just pushed me. I knew I was pushed to say, hey, look, you ain't going to get this job right now. You better make sure that you're. And I might have thought I deserved it, which I probably did. But, like, I was smart enough and disciplined enough at that time to understand the bigger picture. And at that time, I was still going to grad school because I wanted to be a hospital administrator. I still didn't know if I was going to coach. I didn't think you could make money off of coaching. You know what I'm saying? Like, to me, it was like, I'm gonna be a full-time hospital administrator, make $500,000, and then I'll just coach like high school, like some high school on the side for no stipend, and I'm good.
Like a hobby. Yeah.
Like a hobby. That's what I thought I was gonna be doing.
Didn't realize there was a much bigger side to things.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So over at Washington, when you were over there, right, you started as an assistant coach, or did you jump right into the head coach, excuse me, and you said assistant AD position and then ultimately grew into the AD?
I was the assistant AD, and the program there, it was one, I would say it was the most underfunded program in Division II. We had 1.25 scholarships when I got there. I think school was like 32,000. We had 43,000 in scholarship money or something like that. Like we had nothing. And so that was across the board. And basketball was probably the highest sport. So soccer was getting like less than a scholarship for everything. We're playing Division II, like independent. So when I came in there, the culture of the program was pretty much, and we're talking about the athletic department, was pretty much, we're blessed to be in Division II. We're blessed to have athletics. And I was like, no, we're trying to win. So I don't care what it is. I don't care if we're going to take 2-6. Everybody understand here, we're trying to win. And so the president, a fellow countryman, Jamaican, you know, we're a very competitive people. And so he could tell that I was just bringing a different energy. And he promoted me. I got the job as the assistant AD in March. He promoted me to head AD in September.
Wow.
As that happened, my boss transitioned to be the vice president. So he was doing advancement and some other things, still like over athletics. I made a bold decision to make a change in the coaching from a basketball perspective. This program that had one winning season from 1992, from 1993 to 2010 when I got there. Excuse me, that no winning seasons had one over 500 season. No, excuse me, no winning seasons, one season with 10 plus wins. There we go. All right. So it's been a long time. And so just revamping that program, we got in there and then they made me the head coach. And then I just hit the ground. I was 26. I just hit the ground running. I thought I hit the jackpot. BSN or whatever we were using back then sent those basketballs and those practice jerseys. And I was going crazy. Like I thought I was our gym seat 150 people. I didn't care. I was the happiest guy in the world.
You had to have learned a ton about recruiting, especially not having any scholarships. Was there anything that, or I should say one full scholarship? Was there much that you learned? Because I feel like you have to really, especially as a young coach, but just you're a first-year head coach. You got to be able to sell the program, sell yourself, sell that you are capable of doing it, plus sell the fact that they're going to have to be going to a D2 school and be paying a good chunk. Was there anything that you learned throughout that process to be able to help you recruiting?
I will say that – so the first year, that team was already good. So I kept the guys, and we just rolled. Now, we were 10-16, which was the only second 10-winning season, the only second 10-winning season they had in 20 years almost. So when I got that momentum to go to year two, I was able to say, hey, look, I'm turning the program around. What happened before is dead. And recruiting to me is just, it's sales and marketing. Like, marketing. If you can sell something and you can market something, you'll be fine. And so understanding the dynamic of kid that I had to get a kid that was not getting full scholarship offers. I had to get kids that were going to teeter, because there's a lot of Division II schools, especially on the East Coast, like that CACC, that don't really offer fulls for most people. So they're packaging. So my thing was, from a regional standpoint, how do I look at the schools in like the ODAC, the D3 schools, which we know are so good. So kids are getting through the D3, JUCO, want to stay closer to home. And then the kids that were going to the NIACs of the world that were probably still going to pay a certain amount of money. So how can I sell to these kids that I'm young, fun, better, whatever you want to call it, and you can still play at home? Because we all know that D.C. arguably is the best hotbed for basketball, if not the best one, the top three in the country, and has been for 15 to 20 years. That part of it was not hard. I would say the hardest part was getting people in D.C. to actually believe that I knew what I was talking about. Like, that part was hard. Because people were like, our kid's not going there. Like, no, he's not going there. Like, we're not doing that. I think that part was hard, but the recruiting, I just learned a lot. I mean, I learned about financial aid. I learned about how to work with admissions. I learned what a FAFSA was. I learned about Pell Grants. I learned about EFC. Like, I learned about so many different things, and then different scholarships, outside scholarships. Apply for this. Oh, you were the class president? Boom, we're going to throw $500 on that. Oh, there were so many different ways to work it, and I just was flexible in what I did and tried to make it the best as we possibly could. And big thing was, just like recruiting, just like with the teams, there's no excuses here. We got to get a job done. We're trying to get results. So figure it out.
Yeah, for sure. What was the biggest thing basketball-wise you tried to change when you took over to have really the second best season in a 20-year period, if we're doing the math correctly? In the sense, what was that year two specifically between year one and year two? I know your talent probably got better in year two, but really going to year one specifically, what basketball wise did you really try to establish to have some success?
I'm really being serious about the details. I think for me, when I came in, I don't do this anymore, but we had the book, the huge booklet, like every play, every quote, every slogan, whatever you want to call it. This is just play, fast draw. This is before all that.
Yeah, the manual. Had the manual. Yeah,
the manual. Just, I can't believe I'm this old. So just that intentional in terms of our preparation in our fall program. Okay, so what we're doing in fall in terms of we ran Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Mondays and Wednesdays were in the gym. Tuesdays and Thursdays were like cross country. And so like, or one day, I'll never forget this, the funniest. I love this kid, Jamie Green. It's like raining pouring outside, right? And so this is like a cross country day. Tacoma Park, you got like a Tacoma Park Creek. It's beautiful. We run like 3 miles. The guys are like, I walk into the gym, guys are all laughing. Like, yeah, I'm like, what's going on? They're like, it's raining. Like, we run. I said, you ain't got a jacket? Yeah. Right. There were some hoodies downstairs, and I threw some hoodies on them. Them dudes ran and came back. But fast forward that, we would be in games that year, and I would be like, they don't run in the rain. They're not tough as you. They're weak. And that was been a motivating factor in getting those guys to understand how much farther. I don't do it anymore. It's 15 years ago. That can push them through. So basketball-wise, it was really just focusing on the details. Like, I was very detail-oriented on our scouts, on our plays, on possessions. My frame point at that time is, okay, we're not as talented as the teams we're playing against, so we have to limit the amount of possessions in these games. We have to be very defensive-minded, and then on offense, we have to control the possessions and make sure we're getting high-quality shots. We weren't up there pressing. We weren't up there trying to score 80. Year one was really about staying in games and then trying to out-coach people, put them in that little fear factor, and like, why are we even in the game with this team? Like, that's what my goal was year one. We were really trying to keep it together. Now, of course, we have 7 losses by 1 possession my first year.
Yeah, but that's a sign of progress, though, because they say the cycle sometimes is lose big, lose small, win big. And that's now you actually skipped a step in year one because you lost small. You may have lost some big ones in there, but 7 by 1 point. Think about that, man. That's all of a sudden, you're 17-9 knocking on the door. Yeah. So that's really good, man. I wanted people to hear that because if you're an assistant or a first year head coach, that very first year is so important to just establish that things are going to be different. Whatever you want that different to look like, it's so important to establish that first year. And then you develop toughness through some shared suffering and some shared agony. Like that running outside, that's shared agony, but it also became battle cry later in the year, because they had a reference point and they had a flag planted in the ground. Oh, we've been here before. 2 minutes to go, that down 10, we'll figure this out. So that's good stuff, man. Really good.
No, and especially so for you, you definitely figured things out, right? You were a head coach, Tacoma, Washington, Aventis, St. Thomas, and then you take a couple leaps, St. Thomas, Florida A&M, Grambling State, right? So looking at the places that you've been, I guess a big question to ask is, like, when you're looking at a new program, you're looking at potentially going to a new school, what are some things that you, like, evaluate? So in essence, like, oh, you're thinking about potentially taking this new position. What are some things that you look at in a school? We could talk, like, the previous schools if you don't want to talk Grambling, but just, does this school have a good program, like the past years? What are some things you evaluate before you step into a new head coaching spot somewhere?
I think the big thing, you got to know, these interviews are usually done. Like, your work is your interview. So, you know, when I got to St. Thomas, it was Miami. What are we talking about? When I look at new jobs, of course, ability to win, administration, like, what is the ability to win? And then what am I looking like on floor versus ceiling of the program? Some programs have a very high ceiling, some have a mid-ceiling, some have a supremely low floor, and some have a... Coming from where I came from in Washington at Venice, I knew what it looked like to have an extremely low floor with very minimal resources. So the ability to win and then communicate with people to help me get to where I need to go. So it's like St. Thomas, for instance. The president, you could talk to Dave Armstrong, he was going to tell you that I was his best interview that he's ever had. He's always told everybody. He's been a president for 10 plus years. I knew that he wanted to win. And he made it very clear with me, you have to do this if you want to win. And if you win and don't do this, I don't care. I'm not hiring you. And you won't last. Direct, to the point, this is what it is. Loved it. Okay, I loved working for him. I love St. Thomas. This is a great school, great opportunity. Florida A&M, Division I. I coached... What is like 13 years head coach. I always wanted to coach Division I. Like, guys that say don't want to coach Division I, like, they're either really comfortable or they're lying. Like, it's just what, this is the truth. Better than you wants me to coach Division I. And with the situation with me and Tiffany Dawn Sykes, how she was very aggressive in her approach, I knew Florida A&M was basically Washington at Venice. You know, Florida A&M has the longest losing seasons in college basketball right now. It's 18 now. Once again, we lost 8 games by 1 possession last year. But we're going to leave that alone. But I looked at Florida A&M like Washington at Venice. Okay. Oh, I know that I can get them to this. If I had gone back, we were definitely going to be able to 500. I'm a whole goal for year one. So when I looked at Florida A&M, it was, I've done this before. Now I have 12, 13 scholarships. I have a 9,000 people at the school. I have recognition. Now, yes, we had a bunch of limitations. And there's a reason why that they've had some situations, because there's a ton of limitations there. But for me in that job, it was a reminder job of Washington at Venice. I do this. I go to rough spots and turn them. Like, this is easy money. We're going to get this done. And then, so the thing about Grambling that is so different than any other job is it's like a built-in ready situation. You got a president who's 4 years old, very progressive, brilliant mind, an alum of the school. You have an AD who's 42, who is used to play at Southern, so he gets basketball. And it's proven of me. He said, you want to say it was 8 out of the 12 ADs in the SWAC have played college basketball. So everybody wants to say SWAC is football. Like, it's turning into a basketball league. So you need to get yourself with some basketball people. And Dante Jackson, which is one of my best friends who moved on to Alabama A&M, he did a ridiculous job here. Like, what he did with this program, he did an outstanding job. So, with Grambling, it was, okay, I've already proved at Florida A&M and Washington at Venice that I can turn around programs that have really struggled. Now I got a chance to go to Grambling, which reminded me more of St. Thomas in terms of the structure was there for you to really compete at a high level quickly. And so when I evaluated Grambling, it was really like, man, in place from the administration side, they have the facilities, they're trying to win. Like, I'm trying to win. Like, this is about winning. Like, let's see where we can go. Win and progress and get this thing done.
You just said something there that I think all young coaches need to pay attention to if they have head coaching aspirations, is that the administrative piece, the president, AD, coach, they got to be in a straight line vertically in terms of being aligned. Because I'd interviewed for a job here in Indianapolis a couple of years ago. It's called IU Indy now. But one of the things I told the AD in the interview was, in the first 30 days, I'd love to have a half day retreat or a lunch or a long lunch with you and the president so we can all define what success looks like. Because you're going to have a rough road trying to rebuild this thing. And while that's going on, we all need to still be singing like the Temptations and staying in step. Because we're doing this, defining what success looks like for when times are tough, not for when times are good. It's easy when times are good to all be aligned, but can we be aligned while it's 3 guys go down with the injury, or it's a 4-game losing streak, or you have some tough losses, or whatever the case may be? Can you all be aligned then? Because as people watch Oklahoma City, people forget 5 years ago, that team had 22 wins. We went from 22 to 34 to 47 to 54 to 68. But they always said, they interviewed Sam Presti, and he said, they asked him, were you guys evaluating wins and losses? He said, no, not really. He said, we evaluated 2 things. We evaluated at the end of each year the professionalism of the coaches and players. And then, did we have a developmental culture? And was everybody flourishing under this developmental culture? We felt that we could evaluate those 2 things, then we're going to get what we want down the line. So I love the fact that you said that, because young coaches that want to be head coaches, you got to make sure the administration is all in. Because a lot of administrations get FOMO, meaning they want what other people have, but they're not willing to commit it right in front of them. So it's great that you said that.
It's alignment. You got to have alignment to get anything done, to really achieve to that next level. When you look at the NCAA tournament and all the little conference tournaments before, how many times do you see the president and the ADs on that floor? You see it every place. And you can see, like, that head coach I think it wasn't it Will Wade with who I love Will, by the way, great guy. He helped me out a ton last year. I want to say Will was Will and his AD at the NCAA tournament, that crazy hug when he like hugged him and he jumped in the air.
Oh, Anise. Yeah, I think you're right.
It was just that synergy that they had together. Like me and Dr. Scott, I talked to him every day. I talked 7 a.m. this morning. Let's go win the SWAC. He like, what happened? I said, nothing. Let's win the SWAC. So that's just a separate between me and him in the morning, because that's how he operates. That's how I operate. So when you get that and you have that synergy from top to bottom, that's how you really get stuff done.
100%. And you have an AD that's a basketball person. Like, I was lucky when I got the Charlotte job. The AD was the first. She had been the first women's basketball coach at Charlotte. So I'm like, I have an AD that's called a timeout before? This is great. Because that's not the case so much. A lot of times anymore, ADs maybe come from the business side or marketing or development. Nothing wrong. God bless them. Nothing against their path. But to have an AD that's a basketball person, that's a big deal, because now you guys can finish each other's sentences just in a different way. It's just a different synergy when that's going on.
Coaches win games. Administrations win championships. Like, we all know that. Like, you can coach your tail off without the support. You're not winning anything. Yep. And so saying that about Grambling, because they had won 2 years ago, I know that their administration knows what it looks like to win a championship and what it requires. That was the big thing that sold me on this.
And I've even had an opportunity this year to go through like the hiring process and look at like, at least talk with my AD. So he was a former coach and just what we look for. And you could tell my AD was giving me great advice just about the process. And basically what he said was just, when you're looking to hire a coach, listen to the questions they ask, because especially now, obviously not knowing about the person, not knowing anything, like if you know somebody and have a personal relationship with them, of course you're going to know a little bit more about them. But this is somebody completely open that we had no idea about. So they listen to the questions that they ask, because then it could tell really how much in depth that they went on research. You could tell that they've been in these positions before and asked these type of questions, because if they're just asking basic questions, oh, they're probably just base level stuff that they found or are being fed. But if they've been in a situation before, they're going to have more experienced questions about res life, about financial aid, as you were talking, FAFSA, all that stuff. Now, it's definitely something that you can get to learn about. It's really the interview process. I haven't been through it to specifically say. I know you two can definitely speak for this more, but I know it's, I feel like it can be a stressful time. Sometimes it can move quick. But speaking on that, right? As I said in the beginning, like, you've hired people not only as the athletic director over in Washington, but then also just being a head coach, you obviously have to hire people as assistants. What are some things that you look for when hiring that person to be able to work with you?
This might be a little controversial, but I never wanted to hire anybody that wanted to be there. Like, you have to come into these situations that we're working in wanting to work so hard that it propels you to your next situation, understanding that you're only getting to your next situation if you win here. But honestly, it's the same thing I did with the hiring of the staff here at Grambling. At this point in time in my career, when guys, and I get it, they see it, I'm 41, they might see, oh, he's moving up, somebody I could probably hang on with him. No, you need to attach your career to your work ethic and to yourself and your family and see where it goes. And I really like in the hiring piece to really see what people's ambition are and then understanding that they have to really win in that current situation to do the things that they want to do. My staff last year, we had three guys on staff at Florida A&M. One guy just got a Division II head coaching job. Another guy went to Louisiana Lafayette, and another guy went to McNeese State. And they're all, why'd these guys leave? I said, they're progressing in their career. This was you can't stay with me. Let's go. Like, this is here. And sometimes they come and look sad. Oh, coach, I'm sorry about this, but somebody's off. No, go. And when the time is right, we'll run it back. And for me, it's really about that ambition. When I'm looking at, you know, candidates, like, what is your ambition? And then what is your track record in the role we're hiring you for? So I would say the biggest difference with Division I is you're not hiring the four best people. You're hiring the four people that best fit each job. And I think that's what I struggle with as a young coach. Like, why am I not getting hired? Why am I not getting hired as a head coach? Why is nobody trying to hire me as an assistant? You know, really, it comes down to how do you fit that role that coach needs? You know, and so, like, for instance, we hired 4 spots this year. One of our spots, which is ops, but also you'll be on the floor, but a lot of ops. A lot of that spot to me also had to be a relationship with the locker room and that bridge gap to the locker room. I didn't want that to happen organically. I wanted that to happen forcefully. Like, you are the bridge gap. So make sure before you even get here, you're working those relationships so they feel comfortable in working with you. And you also know me and understand me. You can tell me when I'm on my BS and I need to do better. Let me get bridge that gap. Now, I might have been able to get somebody from a much higher level with Division I experience to do that. But they might not be the best fit for me in terms of knowing me and understanding what we need to do for this particular job. In the hiring place, just for me, you know, I'm looking at how are you going to fit as organizational structure? It's like taking a team. You're building a team. You're not going to take 12 point guards because they're the best players. You're going to mix and match whose roles work with who, whose personalities work with who, and then how can you work in my culture? Like, I'm very, for lack of better words, when we're in those lines, it's crazy, it's serious, but I run it pretty loose. What's up? How we doing? Dapping everybody up, making jokes. Like, this is a hard enough game. We try to make it an enjoyable experience for our players and our staff as much as we can for the longest season of any sports that are in college. We have the longest season. Really, when we're looking for staff, that's how I build it, is what is the best situation in terms of each particular job, and then how does that interact with me and then the players that we're bringing in. And so I learned this over the last 2 years, because you can imagine the calls that I got when you get back-to-back Division I jobs. Like, my phone didn't stop waiting for – my phone rang yesterday. Our stats are done. So it really does.
Yeah. And 60% of those calls, you don't even know who it is. Like, you don't even know how your number got out.
Well, you're mad that it got out, but you got, you know, I think the first thing that I did, the mistake that I made was especially from being an NAIA coach for so long, I've been to the Final Four and nobody wants to talk to you for a decade. I've been through that period. It's a horrible place to be as a young coach. It is a very difficult place to be from an emotional standpoint, from a confidence standpoint. Like, you don't know where to go. You don't know who to talk to. And nobody wants to talk to you because they don't think you can do anything for them.
That's called the logo size up is what I call it. It's like the logo size up. Like,
I have not worn a logo to the Final Four in 3 years. I love it. I love it. I just wear like a Lululemon shirt and just let you guess. If you don't.
Good old Lululemon.
And if you don't.
I never did. Yeah. I never did. Because those who mind don't matter. Those who matter don't mind.
Yeah. So I just think when you're going through that process as a young coach, I was very intentional in my later NAI years of making sure I was connecting with everybody, like trying to help guys. Like, on Twitter, I was putting out, call me if you need something. During the pandemic, we didn't play. So I was on Zooms every day with young coaches connecting, doing this and doing that. The problem when you get in that is now you get a job and everybody thinks they're your man, and now you got to put everybody on. So my first job, I talked to everybody who called me because I didn't want it to perceive that I moved up a level and then I changed who I was. I'm never going to change who I am. That was a mistake. It took too long to answer all these calls. The second go round, it's been a lot more direct, and then also still had a lot of conversations because I was unsure how we were going to do things here. It's understanding Louisiana, and then now we're basically into Texas now too. So an hour from Texas. I'm really into Texas and who can help us in Texas. Those are the lessons that I learned in the hiring process. The biggest thing I can say about it for you young coaches, do not take it personally. Like, you can take it personally for an edge. I took it personally and I use it as an edge to propel me to work harder where I was.
Completely. I agree with that.
But don't take it personally where you go into a Debbie Downer and you're a woe is me and now your victim mentality that you blame your players for having when they don't play well as well. Use it as motivation, get better, and start connecting with people.
I feel like then ultimately your mentality off of exactly what you just said, if you start getting that victim mentality, at some point maybe that position will come about and you'll find a job. but then your mentality is already created that you have. And then once you get into that role, you might not have the work ethic that you could have built during the offseason or when you didn't have that job. Like, you're creating that mindset to step into that position. No, that's great advice. So I want to ask too, like, with your experiences, and I know you mentioned it a little bit early ago, stepping into a program, going back to that, but once you step into a program, now talking more like offensive, defensive end, you don't necessarily, I'm not asking you to give up what you're going to be doing at Grambling. We're not asking you to give the Kool-Aid juice over here that's going to give away all the secrets, but just like in previous positions that you've been in, building an offense and a defense around the roster that you had. I know you mentioned that you've had the teams that you have coached, you've kept the rosters on, and at least were able to build them after the first year. Like, when you first step into that, how do you frame an offense and a defense around the roster that you have?
Barry, so my first jobs, I had the team that we had, and I knew what the talent base was at Venice, so I knew how I had to defend. And I knew how I had to play offensively, as I talked about, like that slower play, just because you had to stick around early on. At St. Thomas, we were very talented, but we had all these bigs, and I'm not used to playing with all these bigs. So I'm big analytical shooting guy, always have been. So, like, it just cringes me of playing too big. It's like a cringe, especially if what they can't shoot. I applaud everybody. I don't even know how they do it. Like, I don't even understand it. Like, it's so foreign to my mind and how you can play two bigs and actually shoot.
which is crazy because Florida did it in the tournament.
And Houston did it.
And Houston, yeah.
Yeah, people have been successful.
We played Florida, so I know how they did it because they was big. These are some big dudes.
Like, yeah, they're massive. Yeah.
These are some crazy big dudes. And these guards are elite. They didn't really need that much space. But it's just, for me, it's always based upon that four out one in system. How can we get to where we need to go in terms of our spacing, our shooting, attacking angles, and then that defensive versatility? I asked my college coach, who I first started with 15, 18 years ago now. I never forget this. He was so ahead of his time. I asked him back then, pick five players, make a perfect team. You pick your perfect team. How do you recruit that perfect team? He said, I want everybody between 6'5 and 7 feet. Everybody can pass, shoot, and dribble. This is 20 years ago. We were in Southern California. I'm thinking like Shaq, Duncan, Kobe. He was just ahead. And so now that's really how my thought process was. So when I came to Florida A&M, I saw just the shooting percentages in the league, how teams really didn't shoot the ball well in the SWAC. We ended up number one in the SWAC and 3-point percentage, 2-point percentage, offensive rating, a bunch of different measure numbers. We were top in the SWAC. So I recruited that team last year really based upon the numbers that they had from an analytical basis to get them to then fall into the system where we're going to do with a bunch of shooting, split screens, tempo, and things like that. What I didn't understand with Division I is how you can watch the athletes on TV, but until you feel them, you don't feel that size, that speed, that athleticism. And so I quickly understood that after we played the number one KenPom schedule in the country last year. Florida, BYU, TCU, SMU. I learned it quickly. And even on our level, I learned it. And this team, the beauty of the last two years is the transfer portal. Like, there is no more, I come into a team like this. Everybody's gone. So you get to build it how you want it. And so this team, I think we have two guys under 6'5", and one of them we just – committed, one of them we signed, is really good player. So, everybody else, we're looking like 6'7" through 6'9", and we just are long, athletic, can switch, can be physical, loose balls. It matters. Offensive rebounds, loose balls, tip-ins, like you get your hands on things defensively, deflections and things like that. So I would probably say that was the biggest difference when I came in, of understanding each team that I had. And then now in the last two stops, really being able to build and really build on my past failures. What did I not do well at? And how can I get better at that at our next spot?
Yeah. It's funny. Your coach was literally describing positionless basketball before it became a term.
Yeah, 20 years ago. It's crazy.
It's really what he did. So if you can add shooting to that group that you have now, you're on to something now, because you're going to be able to be disruptive defensively, it sounds like. You're going to have length. You're going to be able to crowd the floor. You're going to be able to score off your defense and break some scoring droughts by getting stops or getting some putbacks by breaking. So those are great drought breakers. But adding shooting to that as well, that's a serious weapon, man, because now I used to love to tell our players at Ohio State, like, the court is only as big as your range. And if you're able to stretch the floor, then you have more floor to play with. If you have more floor to play with, that's why when Steph crosses half court, all bets are off. But that's one guy in history that can do that. Now, everybody else, you deal with the three-point line. But just being able to stretch the floor like that, now shooting and spacing become boyfriend and girlfriend because it's a bigger floor to work with. Man, that's – but the way you've assembled that crew right there, I love that because – and from a depth standpoint, it allows you to, you're not really, lineups aren't based on so much size and this and that because you've got interchangeable size. So now you can go 9-10 guys deep if you want to. So that's good stuff, man. I like that lineup structure.
I wanted to ask at least a final question. I know it's bright and early for you in the morning. So we don't want to. We got to make sure I know we got you probably before your coffee and everything. I know you said you were getting some stuff done this morning, but we appreciate you for being on here. We typically like to tie it up with just one final question. And that question just being bringing you back. I know how you mentioned you started as an assistant, but then ultimately take a Tacoma head coaching position. We were to put you back into your first coaching positions, right? Knowing what you know now, is there any advice you would share with your younger self?
I would say just for me and my journey is, patience, but persistence. You have to, it's funny, I always like to tell people I have no patience. I don't really think I do. But back then, just understanding like the working of your craft and how you build it and your flexibility can help you move forward. And I love my journey. I love the downs of my journey. I love the ups of my journey. And that's the thing I really want to tell the young coaches is you're really going to be built on those failures. That's what it really is about. And so that's what I'm telling myself right there. You're going to fail, but you're going to be better because you failed. So don't look at your failure as the end. Look at it as your future. And so as long as you can turn that around, then you're not going to get fired. You're going to win some games. And you're going to get some more jobs. But we all have been in a situation where we failed. And then we've come back from it. The really good ones come back from it much stronger than they went into it. No and doubt. So. You know, it's been a journey and it's going to continue to be one as we keep, you know, keep this thing moving forward. And I really appreciate you guys having me on. Full circle coming back on. I haven't been on in a long time. And I really appreciate you guys' time this morning.
No, yes, man, this was great, man. Fail forward. That's a great way to put a bow on all this, man, is fail forward. But yeah, everything you shared, it's going to resonate and touch regardless of where people are in their situation. But just the way you shared it is so good because we all got to run our own races. And we talk about there's so much FOMO in our profession and social media creates a lot of the stuff. So you really got to run your own race. And so the way you broke that down today, man, this is great, man. We wish you the best. We know you got a couple Grambling fans as of today, man, because I know one thing, Rising Coaches got better because of that. So this was really good. We appreciate you.
Thanks, fellas, a lot. Really appreciate the time.
Yes, sir. No, thank you. And everybody, thank you for tuning in, being able to listen. And for all of you out there, as I always say, we appreciate you for just giving us the time of day. Coach Crary, we obviously appreciate you for giving us the time of day just to be able to chop it up and talk some hoops. And everybody else out there, another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast. Alan Major, Doug Caputo here. And all you coaches, keep working. Keep rising, coaches, and failure, don't let it set you back. Talk to you all soon.
Help your players get more out of their training sessions with our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. As the official shooting machine of Rising Coaches and the number one selling shooting machine in the world, Dr. Dish provides an experience packed with more reps, more motivation, and just plain out more fun. Be sure to mention Rising Coaches for an additional $250 off select Dr. Dish shooting machines. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together.